So, a while ago, we're going to begin with a meditation. And a while ago, I developed a little meditation that I still find very useful. It's very useful here. You can practice it with mosquitoes, biting flies, the wrong temperature. And it began from working with when you have an itch, or a tickle, or something like this. So the meditation has this name, Don't Scratch the Itch. And all you have to do, we'll just do 10 minutes of it now, but you may wish to take it on as your main practice, become a devotee of the Don't Scratch the Itch, and accredited qualifications will be given out at the end to people who've mastered the practice. All you need to do is wait to have an itch. Or if you're lucky, you get visited by a fly and it gives you one of the smallest massages that's ever been given, or the acupuncture ones that we seem to have here. And mosquitoes also doing this, yeah. And all you need to do is when you get that feeling, I want to scratch, I want to itch, I want to move, I want to fiddle, I want to shake, I want to do all those kind of things. You just think, what I want to do is I just want to watch the wave of the sensation increase. And it will eventually decrease. And all I want to see is like, can I do that with an itch? Yeah, because an itch isn't the most unpleasant thing in our life. Yeah. But it can be a practice to do that way. Yeah. Okay. So enough talk. Let's practice together. First of all, thank you so much for being here to practice together. It's a real pleasure to be in the presence of your practice, your life. Really appreciate it. Okay, so I'll be silent, see if you can get an itch. So thank you for doing that practice. Or maybe you forgot and just did your usual meditation, whatever it is. If you did do it, then you might see there are quite a few interesting ingredients that we added into the experience there, and it changes things. Yeah, changes our relationship. Typically, we don't want itches or flies to land on us and those kinds of things, and that actually leads to a way that we experience those things because of the not wanting. And then also, we often don't pay that much attention to how it changes, how dynamic it is over time, how freeing that can actually be to see things as, well, to see things in a different way. Yeah. Maybe I'll just own it at this point. I think I'd rather just sit in silence than talk to you, but I'm gonna say some things. I'll probably get into it after a little bit of time, but yeah, it just feels really nice just to be with you on that level. So I'm going to, you know, kind of allocate a certain amount of my perceptive quality just to the shared silence as we talk on top of that, and hopefully not disturb it too much. You may or may not feel that we're kind of settling into the retreat and things are finding their place, their pace. Maybe feels very different than the last time you were on retreat or what you imagined it would be like. But I can just say, from my perspective, something's shifting, opening, exploring. And it's been a real pleasure to get a chance to, you know, between us to meet more or less everyone already. And yeah, really honor and respect your practice, your life, your being here. So what I thought I would talk about is truthfulness and confidence, the confidence that comes from truthfulness. So Dharma, one way of looking at what the Dharma is, the path of awakening, what all of that is, it's actually could be said to be about loosening our kind of blind faith that this is reality. Yeah, it really seems like this is reality, like you're awake, you're present, you're feeling stuff, like this is what's really happening. Yeah, and that's how it should feel to a human being, right? That's how it should feel. It should feel like, yeah, this is what's happening. And then when it changes, and it's actually quite significantly different, you know, and we see it differently, and we're like, this is what was really happening. I just didn't see it very well the last time. So we always have this sense, is like, yeah, this is how it really is, yeah. And that's how it should be. I think I heard it at one point, you know, if you don't have this kind of quite assured sense that this is reality, your system will think that it's been poisoned, right? And then it will want to vomit. And that's why we feel a little bit queasy sometimes when we go into a more subtle state, or the sense of self drops away, or some sense of time shifts or whatever. It's like, whoa, don't like that, yeah. Stomach turns over, that kind of thing. So we don't want that. We don't want everybody starting to vomit, you know, and in the meditation hall or out in the grass or anywhere else. And we don't want people to be thinking, you know, I've lost all contact with reality. You know, I've lost my grip on reality. Yeah. But something like a middle way of, or kind of a middle way between thinking, you know, this isn't the only way that this could be appearing. Yeah, this isn't the fullness of reality. Yeah, it isn't really real. It's not really like this. And then without falling over to the other side of actually saying there's nothing real, there's nothing that we can say about anything at all. Yeah. And this is why we actually have a teaching of dependent origination. How do things come into being this way? Yeah, and we talked about experience. Experience depends on what you're paying attention to and how you're paying attention to it. Change either of those things and you start to change your experience. Right? So truthfulness, that's what we apply to our experience, right? Truthfulness or honesty. It was like this right now. Truthfulness is something a little bit different than truth, the truth of something, like how things really are. And how things really are is a phrase that you hear in the Dharma, in meditation, in spiritual circles or whatever. Yeah, I was being with things how they really are. That's a particular way of being that revealed things to be that way. And if you were with them in another way, they would reveal themselves to be another way. So there isn't really a way that they really are. It's just a way that they really were, dependent on what I was paying attention to and how I was paying attention to it. Yeah, does that make sense? Even if it doesn't make sense, it's still true, isn't it? No, it's but it does make sense that we see in our experience, what we do in meditation is we're changing one of those dimensions all the time, aren't we? That we're choosing, I'm going to pay attention to this. Or we're choosing, I'm going to pay attention in this way. Right? Does that make sense? That's what we do in meditation. Yeah. It's also what we do when we're not meditating, right? But with less choice. The difference, why we would say something is a meditation, is because it's skillful. It brings more freedom. And that's why we do it. Freedom is known through the felt sense of more harmonization, more gatheredness in the being, and also a more subtle, more delicate, more delightful way of seeing something. Yeah, and that's what we were exploring in the Don't Scratch the Itch. Normally itches are problems, things to be solved, things to be scratched and gotten rid of. And here we took a different approach. Okay. So, we could say, you can say it if you like, other people say it a lot of the time, you know, the Dharma is about, you know, revealing what is true, as if true is a thing that we can get to know. I only agree in so much as I think that we can see that things dependently arise, and I think that that is true. And that's a reliable truth. And what we actually find is that things respond to patterns of behavior. Yeah. If you add more aversiveness to something, it becomes more solid. Yeah. And like, that's something you could say pretty reliably true. Yeah. When you withdraw that aversiveness to something, it becomes more dynamic, fluid, free, you know, moves in those ways. So those kinds of things are quite true, quite reliable, yeah, and you can kind of see it. So if you're having an experience and things seem really solid and rigid and tight and all of that, it's like, am I being aversive? Yes. As usual, of course I am, yeah. Or we could ask that question in a more skillful way, which is like, could I be less aversive towards this? Yeah, could I, just a little bit less, just a little bit less. And we'll notice over time, if we kind of run the experiment, I feel lighter, things feel lighter. This is quite a nice way of going about things, yeah. So maybe we can't say something true about, you know, this experience is like this, but we can say something useful and also to some degree true about how we might approach it, how we might go through it, yeah. So truthfulness and honesty are, for me, pointing towards that. Pointing towards that, and also pointing towards, I see myself like this right now. Yeah, this is how I'm coming into being. One way we could also describe it is truthfulness and honesty is actually stepping out of exaggeration. So, are you the kind of person who always exaggerates? always exaggerating. Yeah. Like, that's a great exaggeration, isn't it? So I'm always fearful, or I'm always something like this. So those ways that we strengthen, build, elongate, and we know that that can't be true because we really aren't that reliable. You know, like, oh, the one thing about me is I'm always changing. You know, it's like, well, sometimes I, almost always, yeah, almost always. And we like, in a sense, I don't know if we really like, but like we tend to seek out these kind of clear definitions. They're like that, I'm like this, it's like this. And that's part of that quality. We feel that reality is reality. We feel that I am like this. We feel that these kind of things can be helpful. And so honesty is like a counterweight or a contradiction or like moves us in the opposite direction, let's say, to exaggeration. And exaggeration tends to make things more rigid, more solid, more fixed. And that's what we're trying to move away from. So exaggeration, for example, disregards the context. Yeah, disregards the context, disregards the other things that were coming into being in that way, like why I responded like this and all those kinds of things, why they responded like that. And that elongation, that stretch in time that we find ourselves in, like I'm always like this. I always say or think that, or I never do that. Yeah. And so being honest, like what's here? How's it going? What's happening? What's present? That really supports the sensitivity. It really supports the humility. Yeah, and really supports the intimacy and our capacity to find an appropriate response to this. Right. A good use of honesty is recognizing what's happening for us in terms of the dukkha of our experience. Yeah. Now, if you are completely free, you won't be experiencing any dukkha at all. Yeah, you won't be experiencing any stress, distress, or anything like that. Yeah. If you think you might not be completely free, then it's a good and kind of honest approach to think, oh, there's some dukkha going on now. Yeah. So we have this word in the teachings. Actually, let's just stick to the English. So the English for this is hindrances. Yeah, the hindrances. And, you know, many, many talks being given on the hindrances. I'm not going to give actually so much another talk on the hindrances, but actually use them as a way of saying, like, how we can use honesty and truthfulness as a way of building up confidence or faith in ourselves. Yeah. So they're great things, partly because they're dukkha. And that's our, you know, main area of interest. Like, can I reduce dukkha is, you know, the path of freedom. Yeah. And also they're dependently arising. Right. So they're not real. Hindrances are not real. They're not really real, but they calm and they sustain. They need a certain way of relating to them to sustain them. Okay. But the honesty needs always to be matched up with the humility. Is that doesn't mean that you're doing it to yourself. Yeah, you're not giving yourself the unpleasant experience. But the pattern that we're undertaking will lead to that kind of appearance. Yeah. Aversiveness is one of the hindrances. Yeah, the rejection, the pushing away, and I don't want this. And that needs aversiveness to it, right? Aversiveness is not a nice state to be in. And so we don't want to be in that state. And so we're aversive towards that state. And that gives us another level of aversiveness. And that just builds and it kind of like goes into those ways. Yeah. Almost all, well, we could say all, one of the ways that it actually kind of defines why it's a hindrance is because they are unpleasant. And typically we relate to the unpleasant with more aversiveness and that builds and escalates all of those things. Okay. So the hindrances sit in the teachings, I think, of them as the five most common ways that dukkha is experienced by a human being. The interesting thing is that you know, you don't have to only have one, especially if you're kind of a greedy type of person. You might want to have two or three hindrances going on at the same time, kind of a polyamorous hindrance relationship thing that you've got going on. Some people like to get all five. It's tricky, but, you know, like juggling five balls, it takes a lot, but we can do it. We can do it. So a good use of our honesty is to say, there are hindrances here. Yeah, there are hindrances happening here. And relating back, I talked a bit about acceptance on the first evening. And each element of the retreat, we could actually kind of go back, review, expand, deepen, make it sensitive. So there is a degree of acceptance there, right? I accept I have hindrances. I accept I'm not completely free. I'm not radically free. I'm experiencing life and interactions and all of that. So the question then is, which hindrance is here? So I need to accept there is a hindrance here. Which one is it? Right? And that could be just a part of the practice. So acceptance here is, I want to make a definition of like something called wise acceptance. I don't know if this exists anywhere else in the teachings, but like it makes sense to me. There's a wise version of everything. And there's an unwise, unskillful, unwholesome version of everything, perhaps. Right? So with acceptance, wise acceptance is, yeah, this is what's happening. I have a lot of greediness in my experience. Yeah. But wise acceptance also includes, but it must be dependently arising. I also accept that it must be dependently arising. It depends on, like all experience, it depends on what I'm paying attention to, and it depends on how I'm paying attention to it. That makes sense? Yeah. Like it can't exist, greediness can't exist without greediness in the relationship towards it. Would agree with that? If I stop being greedy about this thing, then I'm not in a greedy state. So I'm not a greedy person. I'm in a pattern language of greediness, and it depends on that sustained greediness for that to become a hindrance and to become dukkha and sustain itself in this. So I have to accept that it's here, but I also have to accept that it's dependently arising, which is the flip side of actually saying that I don't accept that it's always going to be like this. Yeah. So you can bring this to bear, this wise acceptance, out into your life, your relationships, or anything like this. You know, I accept there's injustice in the world. I accept that there's inequality in the pay of men and women in society. I accept that that's happening, but I don't accept that it's always going to be like that. I accept that it's dependent on some version of ignorance and misunderstanding and unfairness and inequality, and I'm going to fight against that for the rest of my life. Anyone brings up an argument that says it's a good thing, I say, no, it's not. It's not a good thing, right? So wise acceptance accepts this is what's happening. I'm not going to ignore it. If someone tells me it's happening, I'm not going to ignore it. But I'm not just going to accept, yeah, that's how it is. That's what we're like, you know. Like, that's not what we do. And that's not what we do to the hindrances. So, okay, so let's name those friends, those hindrances that we get to meet, yeah. So this may or may not be helpful for you because it's an English word, but to make it easy to kind of tune into the hindrance factors, I like to use this five-letter word, drags, D-R-A-G-S. And it's kind of nice because they kind of drag us down a little bit. There's also a friend of mine said that it could be like we're wearing drag. I don't know, that might be a helpful way of remembering it. But then, so it's an acronym. So there's D. Typically, we call it doubt. It's the lack of faith and confidence in ourselves, the faith and confidence that we can actually build through meeting the hindrances. Yeah. So it's a factor there. It's usually a factor in most hindrance experiences. Typically, we're doubting that there's something that we can do. We're doubting that it's dependently arising. Yeah. We're doubting that we have the creativity, that the teachings are there to help us to, or help anyone to be able to meet their experience in more skillful, wholesome, beneficial ways. So the D is doubt. The R stands for this restlessness that we feel at times. Yeah, those times, basically, we could say when there feels like there's too much energy for the amount of space that we have. Yeah. Whoa, too much energy. We can do all kinds of stuff with that. Yeah. The A is the aversiveness, which we mentioned is this noose that gets tighter and tighter and tighter as you get aversive about the aversiveness that we're experiencing. Yeah. The G, so D-R-A-G, we've got drag, is greed. Yeah, wanting more, particularly on the sensory level of wanting more. Desiring freedom is not greed. Yeah, desiring freedom and desiring the happiness of other beings, that's not greed, right? Greed is really about gimme, let me get, drawing in, pulling in towards us, that way grabbing, grasping onto things. And the S is sluggishness, yeah, like the lack of energy. When we're feeling dullness and disinterest. And there's too little energy for the amount of space that we have there. And there's loads of things that we can do about that as well. So all of the hindrances, there's always something that we can do. There's always something we can do. And in fact, just in that realm of, okay, I accept that this is here. I accept that there's greed here. Then we actually open a certain space. The space which becomes the whole playground of the practice. What we're going to do, what we're going to bring in, how we're going to relate to this. Okay. So, you know, this maps over all kinds of other things. Those of you who know the Four Noble Truths will recognize that the first noble truth is in life, there is dukkha. Yeah. So in a human experience, there are hindrances. And the first task there is recognize it. Yeah. Understand that that's what's here. Another way of saying that is expect them. Expect them. Yeah. And if you can, don't be disappointed that they've all come to spend some time with you. Yeah. If we're not fully liberated, they will be there. The interesting thing is that sometimes they're here, but they're so subtle. We've never met them like that before. Yeah. Like aversiveness could be just like, yeah. Not quite it. Yeah, it's not full-blown, you know, hatred or certainly anything like that. But just like, I'm not feeling it. No, I don't want to do it. So that sense, they actually go subtler and subtler. So the hindrance teaching can actually be something that we can bring into being at any time. So yeah, helps to be honest, to presume, to assume, to just know they're here, whether I see it or not. Now, there is a slight danger of like a negativity bias and like we're just looking around for like, oh, who's come, you know. But hopefully by balancing that honesty with humility, not taking it personally, I find that really actually helps. These are universal patterns that most people don't choose to meet in a skillful way, right? So it's actually, I'm going to be the kind of person who dissolves hindrances. That's a really beautiful, noble way of regarding our experience. And I accept that they're here and I accept that they're not permanent. I accept that they're dependently originating. They don't have their own nature. They actually depend on ways of relating to them. Right? Depend on ways of relating to them. And what we do in our practice is we change those ways of relating. And that's the core of what I want to be talking about. So we could say more about the hindrances. We could say more about, you know, all of these types of patterns and things like this. But the core principle of it is that well-being is possible for us. Well-being is possible for us, but we have a tendency to find ourselves in these kind of pattern languages of pushing and pulling on sensory experience, trying to get rid of them, trying to get particular ones. We tend to be a little bit off balance in terms of our energy, a little bit too much, a little bit too little. Yeah. And we can, as practitioners, you will all have done this for, you know, days, weeks, months, years, maybe lifetimes of finding out how it is that we can adjust those energies. Yeah. And what we would say is it depends on action, right? Depends on how we respond, on how we act. So So we talked about like that acceptance that brought that little bit of space, and into that space we can bring a different way of relating, a different way of acting, a different way of holding. And that's really in alignment with the Buddha's teachings. Actually, before we come to the Buddha, I came across this phrase from someone called Rollo May, who worked alongside Viktor Frankl as developing the existential psychotherapy work that Viktor Frankl is quite known for. They said this: human freedom involves our capacity to pause between stimulus and response, and in that pause to choose the one response towards which we wish to throw our weight and incline our hearts and minds. So human freedom involves our capacity to pause between stimulus and response, and in that pause to choose the one response towards which we wish to throw our weight. So in that pause, inclining the heart mind in different ways of relating, different things to pay attention to, perhaps in different moments. And so the way that the Buddha phrased it was, what, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? What, when I do it, will lead to long-term well-being and happiness? Which is really like where we incline, what we intend, how we attend, yeah, including all the ways that maybe feel like non-doing and undoing. Yeah, like cultivation's not always kind of constructive. I spoke about it as like planting the seeds. And, you know, it's really important to keep in mind it can also mean actually dependently fading things, removing things, alleviating things, resolving, dissolving those things. And so I'm just going to mention a few things and to get on to the principle of doubt. So if we find ourselves in a situation where there's a lot of kind of greediness going on in our minds, you know, it's like I'm thinking about things, I'm planning my, you know, redecoration of this, or like something that I'm going to buy and then make my life so much better and all of this kind of thing. My mind does that sometimes. I'm probably a greedy type of person if my inclination is in one direction. And so something I like to do after I've thought about all of that is like, don't give that to me. I'm going to give it to someone else. Yeah, and you just like flip it on its head. Same materials. I've just built this whole thing. And instead of it going into greed, it just goes into generosity. It's like, who should I give that to? And it just flips it out, dissolves it from being a hindrance into being an opportunity for generosity. Yeah. And if it doesn't feel right, you know, you could also just say, okay, I'm going to forget about that and think about generosity. Think about how much happiness comes from generosity. Yeah. Equally, if you find yourself in a situation where you're being very negative about yourself, about other people, and it's like all of these kinds of qualities that come up to us, yeah, it's like we think about that. So, okay, well, what's actually really good about this person? Yeah, and just like change that direction. What's actually a good thing that this person does? This person, me. What is anything good that I do? You know, nothing. Okay. You're not trying hard enough. You know, it's like, so try and see the beautiful, see the generous, see in that way. And so we see in those ways, we want to transform, flip it into a different mode. Equally in the teaching, sometimes it's just talked about, just see the drawbacks of that. Yeah? If you're telling yourself, oh, if I get this, and da, 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 it's like, what are the drawbacks of that? Oh, then I have to look after it, clean it, you know, fix it, you know, like, then I have another thing, because I've already got something a bit like that. It's like we start to see the drawbacks. Whereas I'm sitting here, you know, being aversive about this person, I don't know, get rid of them, and you know, what are the drawbacks of that? endless drawbacks of living a life like that, right? And so it's really helpful before we get involved in those ways, all the further friction and stress that are going to come from that. So there's always something we can do, and those are just like you know, off the top of our heads, you know, like my head, your head, you know. What happens when we do that is it builds up this strength of confidence. Ah, there's some way of meeting this. And the confidence that we want to be able to have is that, okay, maybe I don't know what I should do, but I know it's dependently originating. I'm just going to try some stuff. I'm going to try some experimentation. And in experimentation, if you've ever done any, you do need to only try one thing at a time. Yeah. It's like, I wonder if this would work. Okay, just keep trying that one. What if I can do it? If I can flip it into this other direction. It can be tempting if someone's told you like two or three different things you can do. It's like, ah, oh, I can really smash it with her. And then we're back into aversiveness to aversiveness. You know, it's like aversiveness to greed isn't really an escape. But trying things out starts to bring up that confidence. Confidence that it's dependently originating. Confidence that there's something that I can do to make it different. Yeah. But let's use another example. The working with energy. Like, has anyone been restless today? Yeah. A few people. Yeah. Owning it. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. Anyone been dull today? A bit dull? Yeah. Nice. Nice. Good honesty from some of the people. Okay. But sure, you know, to some degree, we've all been restless, we've all been dull, you know. And did we do something about it? Did we try something, experiment with some things? Yeah, good. So, yeah, you're on the path, right? Working with our energy in these ways, so many ways that we can work with this. And each of the way, as I say, trying to just do one at a time. So when the mind is really dull, right, or it feels like there's not enough energy, there's often not enough interest, not enough curiosity, not enough sense of, ooh, I wonder what this is really like. Yeah, it kind of has this, it's like this, there's nothing here, you know, so there's nothing to do. I haven't got any energy at all, apart from enough energy just to complain about how dull I am, you know. And so, oh, that's interesting. That's quite a passion project I've got towards my dullness. But where is the dullness, really? It's like, you know, look around for it. It's like some kind of cloud in the mind or whatever. It's like, where's the edge of that? What else is around there? And you start exploring in this way, which actually just reminds me of something I hadn't meant to say it, but I first heard this from Rob Bebea when he talked about this kind of feeling of like boredom. That we're having this feeling of boredom in our life. And one of the really great responses to boredom is to try and become more bored. Because the boredom has an aversiveness in it. Like, for whatever reason, it's calm. Nothing much is happening. Some days we would have just paid somebody to give us an experience where there's not so much happening. And it's like, yeah, but it's not enough. I wanted more. I wanted something else. And we have this aversiveness to him. So like trying to get more bored, you know, breaks that spell, breaks the way. So it's another one of these little experiments. It's always something we can do. And some of it just comes from like defining what it is that's actually happening. You just need to put enough energy in. It's like, I want a clear definition, like what actually is the proposition? What is the situation for us right now? And that's why, rather than using the words restlessness or dullness as things, is actually it's like too little energy for the space that I'm in. Yeah. And those actually become two ingredients I could play with. Like, it's the amount of energy, it's also the amount of space. So as well as that, working on that level of boredom that we just talked about, what could we do there? So in terms of getting more energy, you could, you know, pay more attention to the in-breath. Yeah, because in-breaths bring energy. Yeah, you know that, yeah? In-breaths bring energy, right? They bring oxygen, they bring energy, they do stuff. There's some kind of exchange around the lungs, that anatomical kind of thing happening. But we can incline more into the energetics of an in-breath. And actually, as you breathe in, it has to lift up the posture in a certain way and elevate the being this way. And if you choose to actually stay up in that more kind of elevated mode, even as you're breathing out, you breathe in again, it can actually come up again, right, in this way. Another thing that we can do is we can actually see it more as an energy, more as a flow, fluidity. And maybe it's not that the breath is an internal thing, but it's actually a lifting, like when a tide lifts a boat like this, actually lifts us in this way. So we can use our imagination, we can use our intuitions, we can use those kinds of things to start changing the energetics of the experience we had, right? So that's a way of maybe like adding more energy into the space that we have. But here's quite a weird one in a certain way, is we can actually like stretch out the space, right? So if you imagine right now, you may think that you exist within your body. Yeah, it's like, well, I have my body here, and we're going to stretch out the awareness through the whole of your body. But you're also kind of aware of the space a little bit around your body, yeah? The proprioceptic, not septic, hopefully. Oh. Anyway, proprioception of the space that your body is in this location, and including that, and maintaining it out to that kind of level. Yeah, it's already kind of brings some energy. So it's actually like stretching us out to that space starts to bring a certain energy. And if you refuse to allow it to shrink, and maybe just keeping it out about a hand's width or so around you, after a certain period of time, it starts to generate energy. And it's quite unusual, but it's quite typical that most people will feel it that way. So it's kind of like stretching out the space actually starts to bring some energy. Yeah. That makes sense? Happening for some people? Yeah. So it's another way that we can respond to this. So it's not like, oh, what can I do in my meditation? I've been prescribed or dictated low energy, dullness, and I guess you just got to get through this one and hope you get dealt a better card next time. So no, you respond to it skillfully, helpfully, in those kind of ways. If we go in reverse order with something like too much energy, so it's kind of the way that I define it myself, is like, oh, it's too much energy for the space I have now. And again, now I want to have more space, but I don't want that stretching out space so much. You can do that, and it's interesting to do, send you in a certain direction with the samadhi that Zaha was speaking about. But what the one I like to do is, I think they do this to hot air balloons. Like hot air balloons want to rise and they're tied down. Yeah, so they're full of like hot gas, and the hot gas wants to rise and it's going to pull up this basket underneath it. And at a certain point they start untying the ropes so that it can go up, yeah, or take off the weights and it starts to rise. And so I like to think about the fact that in this one it's like the awareness wants to shrink and I'm stretching it out in the one before. Yeah. And this one is like, what would happen if I recognize that awareness is already vast? Yeah, awareness is already vast. So this awareness that you think is kind of there, it was stretched through your whole body, your awareness is this whole room, isn't it, actually? Like, I'm in your awareness. Yeah, you're aware that we all came in here, where all of us are sitting in your awareness. Right, and so it's all the way around here, but it doesn't stop there. Like, you're aware of the space above, the building above you, you know, the thing, the most distant sounds, all of this, and your awareness is just perfectly happy to extend and expand and go in all kinds of ways. You know, it's a full moon, woo, up it goes, you know, out to go around the moon. What about the dark side of the moon? There's the sun, way, you know, it's like keeps expanding, going out to space, and all we're doing is just like untying the ropes of that's holding down this hot air balloon of your awareness, which is vast, 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 vast. Now, have we still got too much energy for the space? It's like, oh, it's actually moving in a different thing because it's actually not internal to me. The energy that I'm feeling as restlessness that may also be associated with worry or fear or anxiety and other things like that, it's intrapsychic. Yeah, it's actually not just physiological. And now giving that the more space kind of opens out, builds in those different ways. Yeah. So those are just a few examples, just to be kind of underlining this thing, is that we can actually cultivate beautiful qualities in our experience. That we take something, it appears like it's a problem. Oh, it's a hindrance. Oh, it's a, I've got a hindrance. Ah, oh, damn. It's a, no, you've got some ingredients. And what are you missing? What are you missing? Oh, I've just got loads of greediness. Well, bad luck, mate. You know, no, turn it into generosity. You know, I've got a lot of aversiveness. You know, okay, so that's what your sharp, critical, discerning mind that can see what's not quite right. What about using that quality, but look at what is right, what is really good? You know, how supportive things are. What about the energy? Can we use it in different ways? Be creative. Play, like Zal was saying this morning, the playfulness. And all of that starts to support our confidence. Yeah, I'll meet anything, as long as it's dependently originating. Anything comes along that's not in some way dependent on, you know, how I pay attention to it and what aspect of it I pay attention to, then I'm lost. I give up. But I've never met anything like that. I've been doing this for a while. I'm waiting for it to come along, you know. But like, everything that comes is actually depends on how I relate to it. Everything. See, you know, we've got a few more days here. If anyone can find something that's, it doesn't mind how I meet it. It doesn't matter. Meet it with love, meet it with aversion. It's always the same, completely the same. And yet that's how we assume the world to be. It's what we presume. So it doesn't make any difference. Always makes a difference. And that confidence in ourselves, even if we don't know how to meet this, we know it must be possible eventually. Yeah, it must be dependently originating. And this is what the Buddha was wanting us to see. And so the path is a path of building assurance in ourselves, confidence in ourselves. Yeah, and it's a path of building conviction, confidence that this is dependently originating. Assurance, confidence in ourselves, and conviction, confidence that our experience is dependently originating, which means that any moment, there's always something we can do. Yeah, it's a beautiful teaching to offer to us. And what that means is if this can be a training, right? This can be a training of cultivating well-being in ourselves. What, when I do it, will lead to long-term well-being and happiness. Yeah, and it can also be a place where we practice so that we can bring this into our family situations, our friend situations, into our society situations, so that we can practice for the well-being of all beings. Yeah, and just imagine like John Lennon imagined. Yeah, like imagine if everybody decided to do that. Imagine if everybody decided to do that. It said hindrances are invitations. They're invitations. Yeah. And that confidence that would build in us to know this depends on how I meet it. And that assurance in ourselves, that conviction, independent origination in this way. And that's what our honesty, our truthfulness serves. Yeah. Let's have a quiet minute together to close. So thank you for your practice, for your presence, for your life. And we'll have half an hour for some movement practice and come together for the evening chanting and practice together at 9:00.